from WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. People who have disabilities, particularly physical ones, face what some social justice activists call ableism. Disability research scholar Julianne Scott Pollack defines the term as a cultural discourse that stigmatizes and marginalizes bodies deemed not normal through medical diagnosis. Not only has she studied the perceptions of people around disabled bodies, which includes bodies that are aging, she's grown up experiencing them in a body that lives with cerebral palsy. Today, she's challenging concepts that support ableism through what she calls performance ethnography, the goal to embody the person we think of as the other and develop empathy, which might also lead to the disintegration of assumptions and power structures. Julianne Scott Pollack is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She has published articles on autoethnography, narrative performance research, and pedagogy. And just this year, Palgrave Macmillan published her book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy. She joins us now. Julianne Scott Pollack, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have a disability that is immediately visible? We're inviting you to join the conversation. How do you think members of the public perceive you? What do you wish they understood about you and your life that they clearly don't? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Julianne Scott Pollack, in your book, you talk about the way people perform their identities. In your book, at one point, you refer to yourself as the way you're performing a young college professor. How you look, how you embody your identity in the world. Why do you use that term, the performance of daily life?
I use the term performance to really get at this idea that we are always being interpreted, watched, we can even think of it as consumed by those around us. They're trying to interpret who we are. They're going from their cultural experiences and trying to fit us in to those cultural experiences. Who are we? What groups are we a part of? What do we represent in relation to them? And so in that way, I'm performing for you right now as your guest. You are performing for me as the host. And we're interpreting each other and trying to anticipate what the other person might be needing, wanting, and expecting, and deciding how we're going to accommodate that or not. That it's an ongoing performance as we interact with one another as each other's audiences.
So then what is narrative performance research? What does that mean?
Narrative performance research is looking at the art of telling a story to another person in daily life, not in a stage. I love telling stories on stage, but I tell them all the time, and you tell them all the time. It's how we make sense of our world. You go through the entire day, and a moment stands out to you so much that you section it off from the rest of the day and say, that's a story.
Give us
an
example.
And I'm going to tell someone.
Give us an example of a day that I think is a day in my life, and you say that's a story that I'm telling.
Ah, well, if you decide when you get home tonight to whoever you're coming home to, and they say, how is your day? You're not going to say, well, my alarm went off, and then I hit it, and then I got up. You're not going to go through every moment. You're going to decide, what am I going to share?
My husband might argue that I might, but go ahead. I take your point.
But you're going to say, well, there was this really interesting person that I ran into that I had this awkward encounter with, and you decided that that one moment needed to be shared. That is a story from that day that you cataloged as meaningful, that impacted you, that now you're going to share with someone else after all the moments that you could have chosen from. And we split up our life in that way of these moments, these stories that have come to define who we are and our identities in this world.
Now, you conduct research by interviewing people, sometimes people who live with disabilities, mm-hmm. and that includes with aging bodies. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. Tell us about that research, and then once you conduct those interviews, what you do with it.
Sure. So what happens is I'm very interested in what we call stigmatized bodies. Bodies, and by stigma, what I'm talking about that is bodies, we decide, are not only not normal, but also unsettling. Those bodies are making us uncomfortable. So I'm interested in uncomfortable bodies. And I've studied bulimia. I've studied people who self-identify as physically disabled. I've studied memory loss. Right now I'm working with seizure disorders. And I ask people, the first question I ask is, what does it mean to live in a bulimic body? Tell me your story. Begin where you want to begin. End where you want to end. I have questions if you'd like them, but I want to know what's meaningful to you, what parts of the story matter. And people love to talk about it. Also, because I always let people contact me. I don't contact them. I send out calls. So these are always willing, interested people that want to be part of this work. And after that, I go through and I listen. And I listen again. And I see, what are the recurring themes of living in a body that is bulimic, that is disabled, that is experiencing memory loss or experiencing seizures? And what can we learn from these shared experiences to help us understand this as a cultural experience that others need to redefine, re-understand, and re-respond to in new ways to have a more inclusive society that accepts and becomes more comfortable with these bodies that are making us so uncomfortable?
You talk about bulimia being one of those categories.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you talk about a friend that you refer to as Savannah, mm-hmm. who was bulimic.
Mm-hmm.
And you even say at one point in the book, actually, that is something that is perfectly normal for an American woman. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, I didn't arrive at that conclusion right away living with Savannah. That was something that came after deciding that I really wanted to understand bulimia on a much deeper level. And so I started interviewing other women that had bulimia between the ages of 18 and 25 at that time, because that was the most common age to develop bulimia. And I listened to their stories, and their stories sounded so familiar as a young woman myself, talking with other young women, this idea of having remorse over consumption, this idea of wanting a sense of control, wanting to be desired, and wanting to somehow purge what feels like wrong or guilty behavior was very normal. I would say even ubiquitous among the women I encountered. And I said, when we look at bulimia, this is a physical manifestation of consumption.
Does ubiquity equal normal? Because we call, in our culture, don't we call bulimia a disorder?
We do. And that was my foundational argument, was describing abnormal normality. That in this way, we're calling this abnormal, but really why it feels so uncomfortable is because it's so familiar. And while gorging and throwing up feels very unfeminine, feels grotesque in so many ways, it's something we close the door to do, we don't do it in front of people, it's really a physical performance done in private of really the public performance we're doing every day, navigating how much can we have, and then feeling remorse when we've had too much, whether that can be eating too much, whether that can be spending too much, whether that can be, oh, I should have gotten out of the sun sooner than I should have, but I really want a tan. All of these push and pulls of binging, remorse, and then purging or promising to purge to make up for it.
And there's another thing that you do with the interview material that you gather, and that is you have a troupe at UNCW called the Hawktail Players,
mm-hmm.
and you have people, and you engage in this as well, perform the words of these people that you interviewed.
Yes.
So they're using the actual words of these people. Tell us about that.
Sure. And that is actually my performance ethnography students, as opposed to my Hawktail Players, which are a little bit different.
Gotcha.
But my performance ethnography students do, as a study comes to a culminating space, I choose the stories that, as I performed them for my academic audiences, resonated deeply. That people said, I really need to talk a little bit more about this person. And so I choose those highlights. And I have the students enroll in a class where they spend the entire semester understanding the concept as I understand it. So they have a deep understanding of physical disability as a physical experience, as an emotional experience, as a social experience, and as a social phenomenon that the culture is interpreting and trying to understand. And so after they've done all this preparatory work, they're assigned a character to get to know that isn't a character, is a real person. And they listen to that voice over and over again. And they do journaling and they do work to understand that character as deeply as they can, in line with the research they've done to also understand physical disability at a deep, complex academic level, and then embody that story for an audience.
This may seem like a silly question, but different kinds of research for different physical disabilities. I mean, what exactly are they trying to understand? What it means to live with CP or?
Well, that is the narrow part at the very end. In the beginning, what they're reading is, okay, how do we understand physically disabled bodies in this culture? What is the experience of physically disabled bodies through history? Why does culture respond to physical disability this way? And then having to do their own emotional interpretations, like, how are you responding? How are you feeling comfortable? What barriers do you need to overcome to not make this a spectacle of you showing how great you can look paralyzed? And more of this isn't just for your demo reel. This is to enact social change.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a conversation with UNCW professor Julianne Scott Pollack about pursuing cultural change and broader empathy through performance ethnography. Her new book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. When we come back, let's hear from some listeners. Do you have an obvious physical disability? Do you think most people make assumptions about you that are flat wrong? Tell us about it on this Wednesday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're exploring how people perform their lives and why one local researcher is using that idea to dismantle what she calls ableism and pursue cultural change. With us today, Professor Julianne Scott Pollack of UNCW's Communication Studies Department. Her new book is called Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy, published this year by Palgrave Macmillan. And we want to hear from you on this Wednesday. If you have an observable physical disability, how do you think that has shaped other people's perceptions of you and the way they relate to you? Do you have a question for Professor Scott Pollack? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Julianne Scott Pollack, just before we went to break, you were talking about your students who, in your performance ethnography classes, and what it means for them to research disability and the history of and our cultural understanding of it, and then to start to get inside an actual person who has spoken about life, that person's life. So what is the difference between a voyeuristic look at someone's life versus an empathetic connection, which I think is what you're after here?
Well, very much so. And empathetic connection can happen on a lot of different levels. And I think I always think that students reach it at different levels depending on who they are and what their own life experiences have been up to this point. But a voyeuristic idea would be that idea of wanting to consume this character. This idea of, like, I am going to really show suffering to an audience, and so how much this is, how terrible this is, and they're going to be really impressed at how I can hold my body this way, and they're going to be blown away by the severity of this other body's experience through my performance. And so it's very much about this idea of, I am going to do this for an audience in order to show my own ability to embody and enact this for them. It's very audience-focused and actor-focused of showcasing my ability. to do this. And so it's not a bad thing to do. It's not that it's fine to do that, and great things can come from doing that, but it's not the goals of my course. And it's not the goals of performance ethnography. Performance ethnography is asking someone to, instead of thinking of how am I going to portray this, to be thinking of what does this mean for culture? What does this mean for society? How can I advocate for bodies like this through my respectful, careful, introspective performance that chooses an honoring of this experience and this body and this story that this person gave me that isn't mine is theirs? How can I perform it to enact social change and make a better life for them, a better culture for them, a better world for all of us to be in, as opposed to impact this audience with my power as an actor?
And we will talk about this more as this hour goes along, but give us an example of what kind of cultural change would make life better for a person who's living with a disability. What are you getting at?
Well, and I say this from someone who lives through a disabled body. For people to not need to either respond to a disabled body as, you're so brave and courageous, or gee, it must be so terrible to be you, or needing to look away because it's making them so uncomfortable, and instead see disability as the inevitability of a mortal body that is all of our bodies, because all of our bodies are changing, aging, and vulnerable, and to want to make a world where your body, my body, everyone's body can keep being included. So making people start thinking about disability as not this horrible thing that happens to some people, but the inevitability of all bodies that we got to get ready for and have a culture that adapts to.
Okay, so put on your Captain Obvious hat for a second.
Of course.
And give us an example of a disabled person walking into a situation in which a disabled body has not been considered or is not included.
Sure. Well, I think a great example of that can be when you see the disabled stall in the bathroom, that the stall is big enough for a wheelchair, but they didn't think of putting the bar in a place where somebody could actually get from a wheelchair to relieve themselves, because whoever was putting it up said, okay, we need a bar and we need this much space total to meet requirements, but didn't actually think of a disabled body moving through that space.
You talk about the fact that you have cerebral palsy, mm-hmm. and this is something that you talk about discovering the way the world saw you when you were a little girl. Mm-hmm. You talk about a moment. You were very young. Tell us about that moment.
Oh, the moment at the beginning of my book?
Yes, in the store window.
Oh, sure. In the moment, I was 4 years old. I had just had my first operation, so I was no longer up on my toes anymore. My feet were flat on the ground, but still facing each other. And I was getting out of a car in what I thought was the most adorable outfit I had. It was a little Minnie Mouse outfit that I was so proud of, and I had my hair in pigtails with little bows. I really thought I was adorable. And as I was walking and feeling the air, I saw this mother and her daughter, and they just looked so sad, and they were whispering to each other. And I then looked at myself in the reflection of the door, and I saw what they were seeing, that my feet were facing each other. My back was hunched because I was trying to balance because of how my feet were turned towards one another. And there was this realization that while I was feeling beautiful and airy and excited because there's toys in Kmart and maybe I was going to get one, and suddenly all of that changed. I realized my very happy body that feels beautiful right now is making people sad. And the reality at that moment, it's one of my earliest memories of how uncomfortable a disabled body makes our culture.
It's incredible to me that at 4 years old, you could interpret the perceptions of a mother and her daughter and connect that to what they were seeing
yeah.
in you.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how I was able to do that. I think the looks on their face, the whispers, the questions were, were perhaps something I'd always heard, but I had thought since my feet were dropped to the ground that somehow this was going to go away. And so in so many ways, I think at four I realized one operation didn't fix this. Not having braces on my legs isn't fixing this. And it made me realize just how uncomfortable atypical bodies are.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of performance ethnography with Julianne Scott Pollock, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at UNCW. She has a new book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Marjorie from Hampstead, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, and blessings to the professor for her work. But this is kind of a remark to people who have a noticeable disability, because we all have a disability. But even as a child, and I've been in many, many, many volunteer programs where there are disabilities, I would look at somebody with a disability the same way I would look at somebody that has red hair. And I'd say to myself, oh, she has red hair. But that would be the end of it. After that, if I were involved with this person, the only thing that gave me a problem is if somebody had a crossed eye. And I really had to concentrate on looking at the good eye, you know. But I don't know if people with disabilities sometimes overreact. I don't know,
You're saying you don't know if people with disabilities overreact to what they think somebody...
What they think somebody's thinking. And, of course, somebody is going to take it all in. But once you take it in, that's it.
Marjorie, thank you so much for sharing that perception. Julianne Scott Pollock, is that something that hear frequently?
Well, I think it's something that helps to hear, to see from a disabled person's perspective. And I loved this one quote from an interview I did with the participants in my physically disabled study. Because one woman said, you know what? They say, oh, but it's just a feather on your shoulder. She says, well, you know what? A million feathers can smother you. And she says that that's what it comes down to, is even if the staring that happens over and over as someone is processing. And oftentimes, people stare longer than they mean to. And not that you shouldn't be able to look, because not looking at all can sometimes make a person feel invisible. We don't want to do that either. But it is this idea of all people saying, well, I'm not thinking about it that way. It's like, but at that moment, when you're like, oh my gosh, I need to try to concentrate on the other eye because this eye is making me uncomfortable, that person is going through that every day as someone is trying to not focus on the abnormality. And that gets tiring. It gets exhausting because it's not just that one interaction. It's interaction after interaction. And there is the comments. There's the assumptions. There's people deciding that we need accommodations when we don't. I've had so many people really bully me into using an elevator when I want to use the stairs. And it's like, you know, I understand that you really are feeling you're being helpful by showing me where the elevator is, but I'm already at the stairs, and I'm going up the stairs. And
so you have to become very assertive.
So it gets to that point where it's like, I'm just not going to follow you to the elevator. I'm really going to use the stairs. And I know you're trying to be helpful, just like the other 15 people were. But we need to be cognizant of that idea of the stairs, the noticing, is tiring, and like that one little feather is adding to the million others.
You write in your new book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy, that you can never forget your body. This comes after you talk about sitting in a class and your toes are starting to curl, muscular spasms and tightness that are part of having cerebral palsy. You also write about one of the surgeries that you had on your legs. Mm-hmm. Would you read that piece for us?
Sure. 1993, it fell out. I'm in Boston's Children's Hospital, and I'm screaming in pain. I'm convulsing, hysterical, and tied down with nylon bands. The bands are soft and seamless, not cutting into me, but strong. I cannot move beyond their 3-inch length. I continue to push against them. Yesterday, the doctors performed a bone rotation. They peeled back the skin of my thighs and pried my muscles to the side to saw my femur bones in half, rotate them 30 degrees, and nail them back together again. My last memories are the prick of an IV, followed by a mask blowing air scented with strawberries as I counted backwards. Sometime during the night, the epidural which numbed the pain fell out. Blood pooled behind me, but the nighttime nurse thought I had started my period from the stress of the surgery and figured she'd wait until I woke up to change the bed. She put a towel behind me in the meantime. By the time they realized the epidural was out and the blood was draining from my back, not from between my legs, the necessary pain medication had worn off. I'm small for my age, and to go back up to the necessary pain medication after it was abruptly cut off is dangerous. I could go into shock. So they tie me to the bed so I don't disturb my legs and traction and can ride the pain until lower doses of alternative painkillers can take effect. I'm so aware of my body, the involuntary tremors that come one after the other without any reprieve. But I'll give you a quick medical lesson so you can stop wondering what exactly is wrong with me. Spastic cerebral palsy results from damage to the cerebellum, the area of the brain responsible for movement. My brain perpetually sends signals to my leg muscles, instructing them to contract, like other people's legs react if someone sticks them with a pin. These repeated contractions are mostly undetectable to me as they happen, but they cause tight, spastic muscles that have shortened to the point that they spin my feet to face each other. When I was 4, the doctor stipped and lengthened my Achilles tendons, dropped my feet to the floor in a 2-phase process. This is the 3rd operation, the one that is supposed to finally give me a more normal gait by spinning my legs so the contracted muscles pulls them forward, not 30 degrees inward. I usually cannot feel the repeated contractions throughout the day, but now, with 2 bones sawed in half, each minor contraction is excruciating. I scream for hours before falling asleep from the exhaustion and the medication that has finally built up enough to quiet the pain to an angry murmur. I still remember that pain clearly 23 years later. The 48 hours following that surgery were the worst pain I've ever felt. As I remember, my toes curl. I cringe. My son moves with my tightening. I am so aware of my body's sensation. The inescapably visceral nature of my body is vivid, encompassing all of my attention.
Julianne Scott Pollack, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at UNCW, reading from her new book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy. You've said, Professor Scott Pollack, that compulsory able-bodiedness may be even more pervasive than compulsory heterosexuality, because the medical community diagnoses disabled people as having malfunctioning bodies that need correction, as you illustrate with this surgery. So does this mean that if you could go back in time, you would not have had that surgery?
Oh, I definitely would have had the surgery because it makes moving through space easier and more efficient for me. I think the important thing to think about, rather than that idea of doctors characterizing a body as in need of operations, and there is unneeded operations that happen all the time for cosmetic reasons that can be painful for disabled people. But that idea to think about that, unlike other stigmatized bodies that have observable markers, that have cultures surrounding what it means to live through that body, such as like when you think of different cultures, with disabled bodies, we're only diagnosed as deviating from normal. To be disabled is just to be abnormal. There is no other marker. And in that way, to think more about, because of that, disability becomes this really negative thing to correct or have compassion on or ignore, instead of embrace as a complex part of what it means to be human in a vulnerable body.
Don writes, does the goal of embodied performance assume the majority of people want to be more mindful, or is its purpose to help others achieve mindfulness? And I'm guessing, I don't know, but I'm guessing he's referring to assumptions that people hold about people who have what we're calling disabled bodies.
Well, when we think about mindfulness, I would move from mindfulness to ease. To have an ease and an embracing of this idea that the only way to really escape our bodies losing disability is sudden death, which doesn't sound appealing at all. And so instead to be this idea of to love our bodies as they change, as they become more able at some points and less able at other points, and to erase that fear, and beyond just mindfulness, because we can be very mindful of our fear, to instead move to an ease, an acceptance, and a love for these mortal bodies that will inevitably change in their ability over time.
Tyler writes, as a former student of Dr. Scott Pollack, I would like to congratulate her on her new book. She was an amazing professor that taught me much about empathy and performance. Her storytelling class was a great experience. He's asking, what was the most difficult interview you ever had to do?
The most difficult interview I ever had to do was with a man who was very excited for me to come and interview him. And I was very excited to come and interview him. He was in the very beginning stages of memory loss. I couldn't wait to meet him because he just sounded so engaging in his email and in his phone call. And when I came in and he started telling his story, his wife with severe Alzheimer's came in and became part of that interview. And that was one of the most difficult but beautiful navigations I've ever had.
I'm going to ask you more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a look at the way storytelling can promote empathy, dismantle previously held assumptions, and change the cultural dialogue. UNCW's Julianne Scott Pollack is here. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday. Our email address is coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. When we come back from this break, more of your questions and comments. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we have Julianne Scott Pollack, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We're exploring the world of storytelling and performance ethnography, why Professor Scott Pollack uses it as a tool for social justice, particularly when it comes to the way a culture views and treats people with disabilities, including diminishing ability as a result of aging. You can share your own experience with a disability or ask a question of our guest on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. Julianne Scott Pollack, just before we went to break, you were answering Tyler's question about one of the most difficult interviews. You said you went to interview a guy who sounded so engaging on the phone and was in the early stages of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. And I was so excited to hear his story. And about 30 minutes in, his wife, who is this huge character in the story, this socialite in an American embassy in England, where they entertained important people, and he really positioned her as the backbone of his success, pushes the door open. And she's in more advancing stages of Alzheimer's, which is why he's in the Alzheimer's unit so early. And she sits down next to him, and he doesn't introduce us. So I'm just this strange woman sitting in his bedroom with him. She has no idea who I am. And throughout the interview, I didn't want to interrupt him because I wanted to let him be in charge of the story. That's my ethics. That's my methodology. But I could see she was very uncomfortable. And she kept saying to me throughout the interview, "Are you getting tired? Are you getting tired?" And that's all she said to me. And he kept saying, "She's fine. She's fine." And sort of dismissing what his wife was saying to me. And so I had this idea of this woman wants this strange woman to leave her husband's bedroom. I understand what she's wanting. And that idea of that, "Are you getting tired?" is a very flat delivery of what might have been a polite,
"Is it time for you to go?"
kind of way to exit. And so and we stayed together, the three of us, for another hour. After that, as we were navigating this idea of her watching me, and with very limited vocabulary because of advancing stages of Alzheimer's disease, needing to communicate to me how much she would like me to leave, but me being in that awkward situation of understanding her husband had this urgency to get this story recorded and wanting to be respectful to him. So trying to be respectful, empathetic, and ethical to two parties both wanting something very different from me was the most difficult interview I've had.
In your book, you talk about interviewing someone who, when you arrive for the interview, he's also aging, mm-hmm. and I think in possibly an assisted living facility, and he seems reluctant when you show up to actually engage with you. And there's a moment when you're aware that he notices your pregnant belly and possibly attributes your limp to your pregnancy, which makes you appear young and vital, fertility and all that. How did that feel, first of all? How did that feel when you felt, he might think I'm limping just because I'm so pregnant right now?
Well, it's something I've gotten used to, that right now I'm pregnant again. Because I'm pregnant all the time, it feels. But this is my fourth baby. And during pregnancy, while my movement is the most limited, people assume now that I'm very healthy, because fertility means I'm healthy, and that my limp is not from cerebral palsy, that it's from my pregnancy. So I become my least able but most socially able, in that people think I am very able. So I have this moment where people assume things about how I'm moving that are not true, but are actually giving me ability through this restricted movement, which is always a delicate sort of conversation to have. But I wait until they ask before I disclose, in a lot of ways, because in some ways, the less questions surrounding why I'm limping for those five last months of pregnancy make life a little easier.
So it feels easier to you to sometimes have people see you just
It's a rest from answering questions. I don't mind answering questions, but getting a five-month rest is nice too.
So this person that you were noticing this with, you chose not to disclose because he didn't ask. But in your interview with him, he calls himself old and ugly. And he says, why do you want to talk to me about this? You're young and beautiful and vital, and you don't have to deal with this yet. Why do you want to deal with this early? And what's your answer to that?
Well, my answer is why I decided to study aging bodies, because I wanted to get more at ease with the idea of aging. I want to be with aging. I want to embrace aging people. And I do believe how to become comfortable is to be opened and to listen and to learn and be exposed. And in that way, I wanted to be in space with him. And he actually did not sign up to get interviewed. He only wanted to be interviewed once I arrived, and I wasn't who he was expecting to be interested in stories of memory loss. So it was this idea of he really wanted to interview me more than he wanted to be interviewed. And that was an interesting exchange. But I do think it's so important to be with the difference in bodies before we have to.
So you direct this troupe called the Hawktail Players, different from your performance ethnography students. Mm-hmm. First of all, tell us about this group and what their mission is.
Sure. They are tasked at the beginning of class to find two people to interview that cannot be from their age demographic. They need to be at least a generation older. And they need to ask that person for a fascinating story of their life, whatever story they'd like to tell that they don't mind having told to other people. And then we spend the semester with them translating that interview into an interactive 6 to 10 minute performance to teach the kindergarten through sixth graders. And we go down to second for that troop. We've done a few kindergartens, but usually second grade. And teach them about the diversity of human experience through the arts, which is a New Hanover County learning objective, through inspiring them to say, everyone around you has an amazing story. We asked for stories. This is what people in Wilmington told us. And you should go ask people around you because they've got great stories too. And so it's a wonderful troop. I love taking them.
And you tell a story in your book about going into a high poverty, also high minority, New Hanover County Public School. And you differentiate between coming in with an attitude of superiority or arrogance and versus a loving attitude. Mm-hmm. How does that show up? How would this troop come in with an attitude of arrogance?
Well, if you come in with an attitude of arrogance, you're like, these students are out of control. These teachers seem disengaged. They should have all been listening more to my wonderful performance I've prepared for them. That's arrogance of you should be so excited I'm here versus this idea of loving perception of saying, I'm here to serve this cultural space. That teacher right there is the expert on what it means to be in this space. And I'm going to take cues from that teacher and cues from these students of how I can adapt my performance to meet their needs in this space, because I am the cultural visitor that is going to be gracious and adaptable and honored to be here.
And you wrote about some of these experiences in your book. Would you read a little bit of that for us?
Sure. This is trying to concentrate a lot of the experiences at once in a short piece here. I talk about what we do as this troop. We're encouraged to apply our students' learning to allow abstract concepts to reach into the community that envelops us, to become interactions to navigate rather than test questions to answer. So I do, but it's uncomfortable. It's risky. Others' places, others' bodies, others' desires, others' goals entangled in my pedagogy. But the students, so polite, so kind, so eager, they're up for it. So we begin. I teach them to look for inequity, to see privilege moving, how it crafts snug centers for some and slick margins for others. They stare wide-eyed, startled, analytical, empathetic. Schools aren't equal here. The poorest children are herded together in buildings with vacant seats, while the richer and richest residents overflow into temporary trailers. Those trailers may be temporary, but those students aren't leaving. Their parents make that clear. Neighborhood schools, the cozy term airbrushes racism's and classism's ugliness, with convenience and community's natural glow. The result? Classrooms bursting with candy-colored polos, soft cotton dresses, and $40 flip-flops. Shining pale faces used to applying sunscreen year-round on smooth rides to bright futures. So many volunteers flank the rooms. Flexible schedules and salaried jobs make good PTAs. Hashtag salt life, an identity marker on their Instagram photos and bumper stickers. A culture as white as the mineral it's named after. Meanwhile, dark bodies clad in uniform colors of strict dress codes meant to contain them. They dodge obstacles that swirl through their exposed spaces, pinning them under judgments of who they are, where they live, and what they'll amount to. Rating. Their teachers, their schools, their parents, their neighborhoods, them is failing. Our troop cannot undo centuries of injustice. We can be with them, value them, let them know that we know they are as capable as we are. They deserve everything we have. They matter. The future is theirs as much as ours. But class ends each week and we move on. Back to our lush campus, UNC White. And the teachers, the bodies there before we arrive and after we leave, exhausted, frustrated, resilient, courageous.
Julianne Scott Pollack, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at UNCW, reading from her new book, Embodied Performance as Applied Research, Art, and Pedagogy. And there we hear the divergence between the majority of the students that you teach, these white, mostly middle class, happy students who may have grown up going to the beach. But you say that they're open to discussions of diversity and equality, but privilege, not so much. Why do you say that?
Well, because I think privilege is not a term they hear in regards to equity very often. We think of privileges as something we earn. That's how we use that term in society. So that idea when you say that you have privilege, this idea like, well, if I have privilege, I earned it. Instead of seeing privilege as a system of unearned advantages that we have because as we move through space, people are interpreting our performing body as belonging to a group that is powerful and comfortable. And so in that way, this unearned advantage of privilege, it means we have to reuse this term, re-understand this term in the context of social change and social justice, as opposed to how we talk about it just in daily conversation.
Megan writes, I'm a graduate from Watson College of Education at UNCW and will never forget a professor explaining to us when we were first learning to be educators how important it is to change our perspective by using the terminology students with disabilities, not disabled kids or anything similar. We are all equal and deserve to respect each other. Just changing this terminology is something so small. It really does make a difference in changing perspective. We are all abnormal. Thank you for what you're doing to educate those. Now, when you were on this program a year ago, we talked about why you don't say people with disabilities. You will say disabled people. So tell us again.
I will use person first language for people who want me to use person first language. So in an elementary school, I would definitely use it because that is what I'm expected to use. For myself, I call myself a disabled person because I feel uncomfortable that this term that I'm comfortable with and embrace as part of who I am has to defy the English language to talk about it. We put adjectives before nouns. And just like I'm a brunette woman, I am a straight woman, I'm a white woman, I'm also a disabled woman. And I want people to be comfortable with my comfort with that term. But I speak from a place of privilege, from someone who has education, has a job that makes me financially comfortable, that I don't feel insecure. So while I do think that if people want person-first language, I am happy to accommodate that person-first language. But for me and my body and my work, I want disability to be a regular adjective that we all embrace.
Carolyn from Wilmington called in and she says, thank you, Professor. I'm 60. Recently in a shopping mall, a makeup seller was trying to push an under eye cream on me. And I said, no, thank you. I'm happy the way I am. Is that what we're trying to move towards? Complete acceptance of the changing body, whatever is causing the change.
And I'm not going to tell people they can't use under eye concealer if it makes them happy. It brightens me sometimes. I enjoy it. But that idea of not feeling an obligation. But in feeling and more of an embracing of who we are.
Near the end of your book, you talk about your own son, Tony, who has seizures.
He does.
And there's this moment, this beautiful moment, when you're writing about a dialogue that you have with him in which he talks about wanting people to understand what it's like to have seizures. How old was he at this point?
Oh, he was five.
Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, Mama writing a book was part of my son's lives for the year that I was writing. And he was asking what I was writing about, and he's seen the performances of my students about disability and memory loss. And so he thought to himself, so he said, well, are you going to do movies about people like me? And I said, well, Tony, I can't just make a movie. I'd have to talk to so many people first. And he said, well, you should do that. And I said, you think I should do that? He goes, yes. And I said, why? He goes, well, because I think people want to understand what it's like to have seizures, and I can't tell all of those people. So Tony believes in the power of talking of embodied experiences to create empathy and understanding.
That's this edition of Coastline. Julianne Scott Pollack, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.